We've been looking in past sermons at this account, historical account, the narrative of Nehemiah. And so that's where we'll be again today, in Nehemiah chapter 2. You remember Nehemiah was one of the exiles in Assyria, having been carried away, the city of Jerusalem destroyed. And he was in Assyria, in the capital, Susa, when he received a report from someone who traveled from Jerusalem in regard to the condition of it. And even though there was a temple built there under Zerubbabel in years before, nonetheless, the report was the city is in ruins, the wall is broken down, the people are in reproach. And it burdened Nehemiah, and he took to prayer. And he prayed for 4 months. And being the cupbearer of the king, he was regularly in the presence of the king of Assyria. And the king noticed his sorrow and confronted him on it. And Nehemiah basically was given an open door to express his grief. How can I not be sorrowful, the city of my fathers lies in ruins? And so, in the providence of God, the king gives him leave to go back to Jerusalem, and not only that, funds his efforts to rebuild the wall and the gates. That's thus far in the story. In chapter 2, in verse 9, we have Nehemiah on the way to Jerusalem. He has been given letters to give to the governors, which is a bit of insight into how kings did things back in those days. A conquering king would set up a governor in a certain province that would rule in his name. Nehemiah recognized that, so he asked for letters to be given to him so he could go in the authority of the king and pass through these other areas without any hassle. Well, 9 and 10 give us that insight, and then verse 11, where we'll be taking up the reading today, is his arrival in Jerusalem. Verse 11, so I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Nehemiah sees Jerusalem for the first time in his life. All he's gotten were reports in the past. And Nehemiah, the cupbearer to the king, is soon to become Nehemiah, the construction supervisor. Well, I want to start by just saying a word about rest here. Verse 11, so I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. 3 days? Shouldn't you get going with it? I mean, we're vulnerable here to any attack. Our families. No, he was there 3 days. He copied Ezra in Ezra chapter 8 and verse 32. Ezra says, thus we came to Jerusalem and remained there 3 days. So you have Ezra and you have Nehemiah, and they both arrive in Jerusalem from Assyria, and they rest for 3 days. There's wisdom in that. They tell me that it's approximately 3 or 4 months to travel from Assyria, Susa, to Jerusalem. 3 or 4 months of travel. That would be moving at estimations of about 9 or 10 miles per day across an inhospitable wilderness. That would take its toll. It'd take its toll on me, any long trip like that. Well, so here's the need for rest. I was there 3 days. Tiredness, you know, it robs us of our positive perspective. The more tired you are, the more glum you are, and the worse situations appear. It weakens our resolve, it multiplies our anxieties, And someone said it makes new opportunities seem intolerably burdensome. Have you ever been there before? I don't have the heart for this right now. I have. Well, what's needed is a break, a leave of absence, a holiday, as they say overseas, a vacation. Even one good night of rest can change your view on things. Isn't it amazing that God has worked it out that way? We've got to have rest. Elijah experienced that grand victory on Mount Carmel over the prophets of Baal. He called fire down from heaven and consumed a sacrifice that was drenched in so much water, the trench around it was full. Well, in the wake of such a grand victory as that, he was struck by tiredness and fled Jezebel. He got put on Jezebel's most wanted list, you know. And he ran away from Jezebel to a safe place in the wilderness, he thought. And what did he do when he was there? He asked God that he might die. After such a great victory as that, tiredness. Well, what was his greatest need? His greatest need was sleep and a meal followed by more sleep. And God sent an angel to see to it. And then from there, he went on to appoint Elisha, and the rest is history. He was back in the fight. The wisdom of Jesus. He had a band of 12 disciples that walked with him day in and day out. They saw everything he did, his power, his miracles, heard all of his sermons. But they were men like we were. And the Bible tells us they were pressed by so many people coming and going, they did not even have a chance to eat. Well, Jesus identified that pressing need, the need of rest, and a time to disengage. And what did he say? Come away by yourselves to a secluded place and rest a while. What, Lord, while people are perishing? So the principle here is rest time is not wasted time. If you need the rest, you got to get it. Charles Spurgeon, in his Lectures to My Students book, you know, he had a pastoral college there. And this book is comprised of his lectures to those would-be pastors. And under the heading, one of his lectures was The Minister's Fainting Fits. He had this to say. I'll read just one paragraph. He said, "The bow cannot always be bent without fear breaking. Repose is as needful for the mind as sleep to the body. It is economy to gather fresh strength. To tug the oar from day to day like a galley slave who knows no holiday suits not mortal men. A man, even when exalted to be God's ambassador, must rest or faint. While we're in this tabernacle, we must every now and then cry halt and serve the Lord by holy inaction and consecrated leisure." I like the way he phrases that. "Let no tender conscience doubt the lawfulness of going out of the harness for a while, but learn from the experience of others the necessity and duty of taking timely rest." So Nehemiah says, "I came to Jerusalem and I was there 3 days." Well, verse 12, "And I arose in the night, I and a few men with me." Now I'll stop right there again. I hope this is not too fragmented for you, but it suits the purpose of my sermon. "I arose in the night, I and a few men with me." I like that phrase right there, "I and a few men with me." Not just me alone. Me and a few other guys. "I and a few men with me." He needed trustworthy colleagues. And we need one another. We can't go it alone. We're not meant to go it alone. If you take a coal from a fireplace and set it on the hearth, it won't be very long at all before it's out. It burns out. We're not meant to go it alone. He had helpers. I and a few men with me. Oh, if it were that way. All the time. I and a few men, a few good men with me. How much can be done? What an encouragement it is. So he needed some trustworthy colleagues. And then we have in this verse, as we go on, this midnight ride of Nehemiah. I and a few men with me, and I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind to do for Jerusalem. And there was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. Well, this is a very dramatic scene in Nehemiah's memoirs. It's a clandestine exploration of the damage that the Assyrians did when they left Jerusalem and took away the captives. It's a moonlight journey. I assume it's by moonlight. If it was the total dark of night, you wouldn't be able to see anything. I assume it was a well-lit night as such. And it was to gain a better perspective on the challenges and the possibilities here. Now, in the last sermon, I said waiting time is not wasted time. He waited 4 months praying to God. Well, today, preparation time is not wasted time. Just like rest time is not wasted time. You know, we have in our minds that these things are wastes. I got to get about it. But preparation time is not wasted time. We often undertake one thing or another in the work of God, both in our spiritual and in our temporal life, without preparation. And for lack of it, failure is the result. It's not only doing a thing, but the preparation for doing that many times brings success. When I was working construction, we had a saying, and it always brought a smile, when the foreman would come up and say, plan your work and work your plan. Maybe you've heard that all before. But to a construction worker, that means take whatever time you need, figure it out, gather up your tools and equipment, and then just do it. Get it done. Oftentimes, a relief effort after a natural disaster starts with a visit by dignitaries to the area, visit the area to assess the damage and formulate a plan, whether it's a tornado in Joplin or whether it's a hurricane in New Orleans. They always put together a committee, get together and survey the situation, and then they decide what to do. Matthew Henry said, a good work is likely to be well done when it's well considered. So here, rebuilding this wall, that would be a demanding and a hazardous undertaking. I can't imagine it. It would seem overwhelming. But Nehemiah here, he was a good model for us, a model of good sense and attention to detail. That's a hard thing to learn, attention to detail. I remember I was trying to teach that to my son. It was one of the most difficult things as he was growing up. Attention to detail. Some people are detailed people. They're detail-oriented. Others just fly by the seat of their pants, kind of here and there. But attention to detail is really necessary in life. And Nehemiah had it. Every section of the wall had to be planned out effectively, as best it could anyway. A good work should not be undertaken without a deliberate estimate of its magnitude and its difficulty. This isn't a lack of faith. This is just prudence. It makes sense. You remember the words of Jesus in Luke 14, which one of you, when he wants to build a tower, does not first sit down and calculate the cost to see if he has enough to complete it? That is, he weighs needs versus resources. Otherwise, he doesn't start. Jesus said otherwise when he's laid a foundation, if he had not done that already, that is, calculate the cost, he's not able to finish, and all who observe it ridicule him, saying, this man began to build and he wasn't able to finish it. Well, here's another matter of prudence. We go on. I did not tell anyone what my God was putting in my mind to do for Jerusalem. And also in verse 16, at the very end of verse 16, we read these words, nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work. That's quite a list of VIPs right there. Priests and nobles and officials and Jews, and not only that, workers. I hadn't told anybody yet. That's a matter of prudence. There's a time for silence. And my resources tell me that this verse here, and this phrase in verse 12, I did not tell anyone what my God was putting into my mind, is in the past continuous sense. So it's emphasizing an ongoing nature here of this communion with God. It wasn't just a one-time thing that Nehemiah received from God back in Susa. This was a burden. It was ongoing. There was a pressure here on him. God was continuing to direct Nehemiah, instructing him by putting into his mind what to do for Jerusalem. Now, that tells me there's a place for subjective guidance. Objective guidance is the most sure. Principles of the Bible, things that are realities that come to bear on a situation rather than subjective, you know, feelings and impressions and things like that. But there is a place for that kind of direction and leadership. God putting it into someone's mind, do this. Do this, do this, this direction. Give yourself to this. Give yourself subjective guidance, creative ideas that were necessary for the success of the effort were still flowing through the mind of Nehemiah. And a good work often starts that way. It starts small and it unfolds gradually over time. That's just the experience of it. We want to have everything all laid out in perfect order and all the questions answered before we ever start on something. But frequently, things build, things become more clear as time goes on. This happens and that happens, and then before long, there's some light and some direction. Well, Nehemiah waited before all of that, before he revealed anything. The control of information is important. When to reveal it and who to reveal it to. And not everything that a leader knows needs to be made public. Bishop Hall says he took a few into his company, but none into his council. You know, in the news, it's regular in the news cycle to hear of a leak. Such and such got leaked, and now what do we do? I mean, they have people that leak things from the Supreme Court before the Supreme Court ever comes out with it. The public's already got a heads up what to expect, and they're ready to protest or whatever. Leaks like that. The control of information. Well, he avoided careless leakage of information that would come about by chatting to every acquaintance about his desires. Someone said opinions are like belly buttons. Everyone has one. And I add not only that, but they're usually front and center. So he avoided the careless leakage of information. He didn't want a bunch of people putting in all of their opinions. you know. One commentary I read said this: good intentions are best kept secret, publicly secret, until it's determined that they're able to be accomplished. Well, that's the time for private counsel. You have a burden, you have a desire, you take it to someone in private, and you determine, is this feasible? Is this viable? Is it practicable? Can it be done? Until then, your good intentions are best kept secret. Good intentions are best kept secret until they can be carried out with decisive energy. You're ready to commit to it. Otherwise, let's just keep it secret for now. Good intentions are best kept secret from those who are likely to oppose them. That just makes good sense. Why would you alert your enemies to what your plans are? You're just giving them the first opportunity to oppose. And then lastly, this man said good intentions are best kept secret until the cooperation essential to their success can be relied on. Then we go public with it. So Nehemiah, he thought it prudent for the present to conceal it until a plan was formed that could be put into action. Someone said he works thoughtfully before he commences this tremendous task. He spends some time in deliberation. Who can tell the thoughts of Nehemiah as he moved amidst the ruins of Jerusalem this night? Before we undertake a work, we should gauge its magnitude and become convinced that it is practically viable. Men, from the impulse of the hour, put their hand to undertakings which they have never given themselves time to understand and for which they are not fitted. And hence, when the excitement is over, they abandon the work in disappointment, if not disgust. Well, let's continue on. There was no animal with me except the animal on which I was riding. I think that means he was riding on one, whether it's a horse or a mule. And the men that he brought with him, a few men, were on foot. And verse 13 through 15 provide the details how he proceeded. And some of your Bibles might have a map. I don't know if Jerusalem in David's day or something like that in the back. It might give you a little bit of a better mental picture of what he's talking about right here. He says, I went out at night by the valley gate in the direction of the dragon's well and on to the refuse gate, inspecting the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were consumed by fire. Then I passed on to the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was no place for my mount to pass. So I went up at night by the ravine and inspected the wall, and then I entered the valley gate again and returned. So it seems like, simplistically, he exited the city from the west, took a left turn, went south, proceeded counterclockwise around Jerusalem, inspecting the walls, until he encountered such a pile of rubble that he had to alter his course because his mount couldn't pass through there. Too rough. And then he completed the circuit and re-entered the city at the valley gate again where he had left it. It seems that was how he proceeded there. Well, now we have the report of all of this. Verse 16, the officials did not know where I had gone or what I had done. You know, he went out in the middle of the night, in the dark. And nor had I as yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, or the rest who did the work. And then I said to them, this is the report. You see the bad situation we're in? That's pretty honest reporting. Nehemiah had a necessary grasp now on the situation. Before, he had just heard reports, but now he's seen it with his own eyes. And it's bad, maybe worse than he originally thought. I mean, there was a spot right there where he had to get off his horse. He couldn't even go that direction anymore. And they tell me that archaeologists have discovered this very rubble pile right here in that location. Now he's seen with his own eyes, and it's a bad situation. Those are his words. Not a hopeless situation when God's involved, but a bad one. And I'm glad that bad situations aren't necessarily hopeless with God. Think of all the reformations. Think of all the revivals throughout church history. They came at times when the situation was bad. We live in a day and age when we look at our own country and we say, this is bad. Never has anybody seen things like this before. Our own technology has created opportunities for sin that rival anything we've ever experienced in the past. This is bad. It's a bad situation, in the words of Nehemiah. But it's not hopeless when God's involved, because there is always a possibility for a reformation, a revival, an awakening. And we ought to pray for that. Well, the wall was rubble. The gates were charred scrap wood. And the fact of the matter is they'd been that way for over a century. Without walls, they had no city. So to all of their hostile neighbors, it was now evidence that God had abandoned his people a long time ago. And it was reproachful. But Nehemiah, he didn't plead or threaten. He was not, in modern-day terminology, sketchy, you know. He was a confident leader, confident in God. And success in a good work requires a confident leader. That's why God calls a man. If a man decides to lead on his own, then there are problems. He likely won't last. But when God calls a man and gives him the vision and enables him for his work, then he's confident in God. So Nehemiah presented a well-grounded proposal in verse 17. You see, the bad situation we're in, if it was modern day in a boardroom or something, he'd have a PowerPoint right here. And he'd be showing them, this is what we got, you see, this is our situation, it's bad. Jerusalem is desolate and its gates burned by fire. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer be a reproach. And I told them how the hand of my God had been favorable to me, and also about the king's words which he had spoken to me. So he had a well-grounded proposal here, and these are the elements of it. First, pragmatism. There's a need. We have determined there is a need here. Well, that's Captain Obvious. You look around and the walls are rubble and the gates are charred. There's a need. Pragmatism. It's like he's saying we're compelled to do something. We have no walls. We have no city. We and our children are vulnerable. Secondly, one of the other elements of it, patriotism. After all, Jerusalem is desolate. He used that phrase. Jerusalem, Zion, this is the city of our God that lies desolate. The temple for his worship has been constructed under Zerubbabel a century before, but nonetheless, look at the city. It's destroyed and the walls are down. This is a reproach to God. It's a spiritual disgrace. When for well over a century, his people called by his name are living among the neighborhood of his hostile enemies in a devastated and a ruined city. And moreover, it's a city that he has chosen as the place to keep his name. The place where his name dwells. So there's an element of patriotism there. It's Jerusalem. It's not Bethlehem. It's not some other city. And then there's a duty so that we will no longer be a reproach. But more than all of that is the theme, maybe, of the entire book, and that is the sufficiency of God. In his well-grounded proposal, he talks about the sufficiency of God. God is in this. The good hand of God is favorable, he used that way of putting it. He smiled on it. God is behind it. If God is behind it, we can get it done. The sufficiency of God. And then he cites providence. And providence is a wonderful tool in confirmation. If you can have some providence that confirms a plan, that's marvelous. Well, he had that. The king was willing. You remember how all of that transpired back in, earlier on in chapter 2. Nehemiah was so afraid of what the king was going to say that he prayed on the spot. And as it turns out, once the king heard Nehemiah's proposal, he granted it to him. The king was willing. There was a cause and an effect. And providence is always in the cause and the effect. They already had the support and the supply of the Persian king. I mean, the king funded the whole trip because the good hand of God had been favorable. And so the argument is, therefore, we should expect his favor to continue. And then there's an appeal for cooperation in here, in unity. He says, let us rebuild. Not just let me and a few men do it. Let all of us rebuild. Cooperation, unity. He identifies with the people. He says, we and us. So in essence, his proposal is God's name is at stake and Jerusalem's welfare. It's for Jerusalem, we read back in verse 12. Well, Nehemiah was a motivating leader. Reminds me kind of like Mordecai before him in Esther's day. Mordecai, we're told, was one who sought the good of his people and one who spoke for the welfare of his whole nation. Doesn't it make you long for that now? If we had someone in a high place that you could say this about, sought the good of the people and spoke for the whole welfare of the whole nation. Nehemiah was a motivating leader. In the backdrop of advancing Germany, Winston Churchill employed some of the same kind of motivation. Let me read to you his words. He says, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. Victory at all costs, victory in spite of all terror, victory however long and hard the road may be, for without victory there's no survival. We shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight in the seas and the oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. And we shall fight in the hills and we shall never surrender. And then in 1941, during a radio broadcast, he said this to our president at the time. He said, give us the tools and we'll finish the job. Now, that's an inspiring leader. And we know how it all ended. So Nehemiah was a motivating leader, and he hung it all on God. The good hand of God is favorable to me. And providence has been gracious leading up to it. Well, the response of the people, they said to one another, let us arise and build. Verse 18, I told them that the hand of my God had been favorable to me and about the king's words which he had spoken to me. And then they said, let us arise and build. So they put their hands to the good work. Their attitude and their energy, it's surprising to me. I guess I wouldn't have expected it. But, you know, God's hand was in that as well, impressing it upon the people to follow Nehemiah. You might recall a century before under Zerubbabel when the people were released by Cyrus, the king of Persia, to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. There was some opposition there that shut the whole thing down once they had gotten the foundations laid. And the people needed to be persuaded to pick it up again and get back on with it. In fact, their attitude was, according to Haggai, the time has not come for the house of the Lord to be rebuilt. They were discouraged and left it off. And so to motivate them to build the temple, God said, when you gain prosperity, I blow it all away. And it's like you're putting it in purses that have holes in them. And God sent a famine on the land. And the sky withheld its rain, and the earth its produce. And on the mountains, and on the grain, and the new wine, and the oil, and on what the ground produces, on men, and on cattle, and on all the labor of your hands. God did all of that. Why? Because their attitude was, this is not the time to build the house of the Lord. And then God sent two prophets, Haggai and Zechariah, to them to prophesy to them and impress them to move on it. Haggai said, consider your ways. And then he quoted the Lord, I am with you, declares the Lord. And Zechariah quoted the Lord, I will be a wall of fire around her and the glory in her midst. And to Zerubbabel, not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. All of this was involved in the days of Zerubbabel to get the temple built. But here now in Nehemiah, he shows up, he gives this proposal after having surveyed all of the damage, and because the good hand of God was favorable toward him, the people said, well then, let's arise and build. And they put their hands to the work. That's amazing to me. God can do that when the time is right. He can just make it all turn in a moment, and everybody's on board. The success of a good work depends on help from the Almighty, even the conviction to initiate it. There are moments when human hearts are so prepared by God that great truths just have to be presented to them, and they're met with an immediate response. When God does that, otherwise people are drowsy and asleep and their mind is everywhere else and the word doesn't affect them at all. But God is able to move that way. That must have been the instance here with these men of Judah. They readily responded to Nehemiah's appeal. His people will be willing in the day of his power. They didn't say, we're content with things the way they are. They didn't say, we've tried that before and it didn't work, which was true. They didn't say, the time has not come. What did they say? Let us arise and build. And they put their hands to the good work. So a good work typically cannot proceed without the support of others. But then that's not all. We've got the response of the enemies. You remember those two guys back in 10? Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite. They were really displeased with the idea that someone had showed up to seek the welfare of the sons of Israel. Well, verse 19, when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite, now I told you that we hadn't heard the last of those guys. Here they are again. And they've increased. And Geshem the Arab heard it. Well, the enemies have increased because a third one is introduced. Geshem the Arab, he was a ruler of Arabian tribes to the south in the desert lands. So geographically, you've got Geshem down south, the Arabs. You've got Sanballat, he was the Samaritans, to the north. And then you've got this other guy, Tobiah, he was ruler of the Ammonites to the east. So they're pretty well surrounded, Jerusalem, by enemies. Of course they need a wall. Someone said, a war of nerves begins. Well, we could say with a great degree of certainty, every good work is almost certain to provoke opposition. Bishop Hall says, whoever put his hand to any great work for good or of God's church without opposition, as the walls of the temple found busy enemies, so shall the walls of the city. Well, it's interesting that even under the favorable hand of God, even with the support of a king, even with everyone on board with the situation, the willingness of the people, conflict isn't far away. It's always right there, it seems, at the door. Anywhere the people of God determine to build, the enemy determines to break it up. And they use two age-old tools here. They mocked us and despised us. And they said, what is this thing you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Very effective, very demoralizing, ridicule and misrepresentation. Ridicule, they made fun of us, they laughed at us. What is this? They mocked us. It's pretty hard to take ridicule, I have to say. And mockery. No one wants to be just laughed at and mocked at. The tongue can be weaponized. In one place, they're spoken of people who have a sharp tongue, their tongue like a sword, and they aim their bitter speech like an arrow. There's weapons there. And for some of our temperaments, it's easier to face violent opposition than it is to bear mockery and ridicule. Some of us are more stout-hearted, thick-skinned, if you want to use that term. Somebody makes fun of you, it doesn't matter. It's the old sticks and stones will break my bones, but words will never hurt me. But others of us are more sensitive, and words do hurt me. So the devil knows that. Ridicule is one of his tools, as is misrepresentation. These guys, these opponents, revived a previous accusation. Are you rebelling against the king? That's what they said all the way back when the temple was under construction. In fact, they composed a letter and sent it back to the king of Assyria and said, these guys are rebelling against you. You've got to put a stop to this or you're going to lose the revenue, and hit him right in his pocketbook. And so he shut the whole thing down. Well, they revived that same old thing again here. Are you rebelling against the king? Well, Nehemiah took a strong stand against the enemy. In verse 20, so I answered them and said to them, the God of heaven will give us success. You got to like this guy. It's a statement of faith. The God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem. He was pretty pointed there, but you, pretty firm. You've got no portion, no right, no memorial. This isn't your city, it's not your God, and you have no concern in the matter. He shut them right down. Well, Zerubbabel and Joshua and the rest of the men back in the days of the temple being rebuilt said something this very similar to their opponents. You have nothing in common with us in building a house to our God, but we ourselves will together build to the Lord God of Israel. A firmness there. And it's based on faith. Faith is a shield, right? It's called the shield of faith in Ephesians. Confidence in God. And that's Nehemiah's testimony. The Lord, the God of heaven, will give us success. God's work is accomplished by God's power. And Nehemiah gives a twofold reason for his faith. The God of heaven will give us success, that is the glory of God in the work, and the conviction that success rests on God. The King James says he will prosper us. The original language literally means he will push it forward. I like that idea. God's going to push it forward. He's going to make it profitable. And then we are his servants, the unity of the people in the effort. So the glory of God and the unity of the people in the effort. And he suggests it's almighty protection and suggests that it's providential direction. And he anticipates ultimate success. He's got fortitude in it. Therefore, we will arise and build. You guys aren't going to stop us. God is on our side. The God of heaven will give us success. So that's what we get from this midnight ride of Nehemiah. You've heard of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. Here's the midnight ride of Nehemiah. Might be easy to remember. You find it in the second chapter of the book, Nehemiah. So we'll stop there for now. There's plenty of principle here for us to think on.